This is an ABC podcast.
Hello, this is Life Matters. I'm Hilary Harper, and it's a new day and a new set of restrictions in Victoria, just as things are easing in New South Wales and Queensland. How will this affect people and businesses, some of which barely survived the first lockdown? You can let us know what you think on our Facebook page, especially if you've been directly affected. It's also a new financial year today, and such a different work landscape and tax landscape. Can you claim hand sanitizer? What about that ergonomic couch and tray table combo you knocked together? There are some traps for the unwary this year. We'll find out how to avoid them a little later in the show. Lately, many of us have been able to sort out some medical issues over the phone when we normally have to get in the car or on public transport and spend precious time in waiting rooms. And a recent survey seems to show that both younger and older Australians like using telehealth. So the future is here, sort of. Is everyone happy though? And why are some GPs still struggling to get enough patients coming in to remain viable? Love to hear from you. If you've used telehealth during the past few months, tell us your experiences, good and bad, and we're particularly interested to hear from older Australians. We're on Facebook. Julianne Parkinson is with us. She's the Chief Executive of the Global Centre for Modern Ageing. Julianne, welcome to Life Matters.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Now, you recently conducted a survey about attitudes towards telehealth, particularly among older Australians. Let's look at the positives first. What did you hear?
Well, thank you. I mean, we've reached out to more than 1,200 Australians in the second phase of what's a multi-phase study that the Global Centre for Modern Ageing is running. And we found an overwhelming support for the experience of telehealth, be it by a phone or via video conferencing.
So overwhelming. That sounds pretty comprehensive. No problems at all?
Oh, certainly problems, absolutely. But we did see that there were two-thirds of those people aged over 18 within Australia that conducted the survey, which was online, more than two-thirds that did experience the telehealth experience found it to be a good one, and one that nearly as many, again, willing to be involved in it in the future. I think we need to take into account, though, you know, that this was during the pandemic when other choices about attending in your normal face-to-face form simply weren't offered, and so therefore we think some of the positiveness could be shaped by the circumstances that were restricting you to visit in other ways.
And Julianne, it was an online survey. Do you think that skewed the results at all?
I think that's reasonable, absolutely. I mean, we know that we have seen an increase in the use of technology for people around Australia, and we see that with older Australians as well. So there's more confidence and more use of technology, but we are very mindful that this survey did reach people that had some digital literacy or confidence, as distinct from others that either don't have access to the technology or don't have the wherewithal. So that is certainly another part of a future study that the Global Centre intends to look at, along with the other challenges that people identified for us that they experienced.
And tell us a little bit about those. You mentioned that about two-thirds of people said it was great. What were the remaining issues?
Well, you know, it's not dissimilar in some ways to other video conferences, but, you know, tech glitches or that lack of apparent tech and the lack of tech confidence played a part. People also had challenges when, for example, when it was especially with a new clinician or a new health professional, so where there wasn't an existing relationship, you know, that caused concerns for people. They also felt that there was a sort of a lack of some of the body languages and the cues that we get in face-to-face, person-to-person exchanges, and so therefore a bit of a lack of warmth that was acknowledged. There were people with hearing impairments that found it challenging, and obviously it's all contextual, right? So it would depend on what's the problem that you're examining or the treatment as to whether it was suitable or not.
Some of the reports that we were hearing suggested that people would love to use it more for things like repeat scripts and those basic, you know, regular appointments, but might shy away from things like introducing a new condition or a sensitive condition. Is that something that tallies with what you're hearing, Julianne?
Yes, absolutely. And doesn't it make sense? You know, it is contextual and it depends on the seriousness and the complexity of what's being discussed or examined. But absolutely, we see and we've heard that for routine if I can say that, sort of consultations, people saw great value and benefit in it. Of course, telehealth isn't brand new, and we're certainly in Australia, in the remote and regional areas, they've been pioneering this for years. It's been the onset of the CBD and the suburbs around Australia that's really caused the proliferation of interest, I think, during this COVID period.
Now, I mentioned some of the reports we'd been hearing. I'll tell you a little bit more about that, Julianne Parkinson from the Global Centre for Modern Ageing. A woman called Val Fells got in touch with us. She's a member of the reference group for the Older Persons Advocacy Network. She's 92. And Val said many older people liked telehealth, even if they had to use workarounds, like, say, a three-way speaker so a carer or partner could join in. But she did have some strong concerns around dementia. She said if someone's in what she called the denial stage, they might just say, oh, I'm fine, there's nothing wrong with me. And she says a person with dementia is much more likely to use body language or facial expression to communicate, so GPs might miss some of that over telehealth. Julianne, how does that tally with what you're hearing?
Well, I think that that's part of the next phase of the inquiry, but absolutely it makes sense that there will be times where it's not just preferred, it's essential to have a face-to-face or person-to-person so that the health professional, the clinician, can assess what's in the very best interest. That's why we're so keen in the next round of our study and using our other facilities that we have at the Global Centre to investigate the experience and the appropriateness of it. You know, I think what it has shown us is that it's an important new tool, it's an important new part to the business model, of an option and a viable option and perhaps a preferred alternative at times. But understanding the parameters for which it fits into the blend of suites of offerings that keep Australians safe and well is really essential for it to be successful in the future.
And Julianne, just a quick word about privacy too. I know that featured very high on your participants' list of important things. And Val Fells from the Older Persons Advocacy Network said some of her contacts were worried that if they needed help setting up a call and an appointment, their privacy would go out the window. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, what the study showed us is that privacy does not appear to be a major concern for most older Australians, or indeed the people generally over the age of 18 that conducted the survey. In fact, it was 95% of people, for whether it was online and a slightly higher number for the telephone, said that the privacy was the same as normal or even better than normal. Of course, let's keep in mind again that this was conducted during the COVID restrictions. And we've seen, you know, globally, but certainly in Australia, that sensitive relationship between privacy versus safety and what we are as Australians prepared to trade off, in particular circumstances. I do think, or what we think at the Global Centre, is that as the COVID restrictions release or ease and people have other options open to them, that we need to consider all of these responses that may shape and be different in the future, and certainly areas to investigate and understand more.
You're listening to Life Matters. Julianne Parkinson's with us. She's the Chief Executive of the Global Centre for Modern Ageing, who've been doing surveys and will be doing more surveys on our experience of things like this. Also with us is Dr. Harry Nespolin. He's the President of the Royal Australian College of GPs. Harry, good to talk with you again.
Good morning.
Now, we'll be looking at some of the implications for GPs in a moment. But Harry, do these findings we've been hearing about ring true for you when it comes to how patients are navigating telehealth?
I guess they're not surprising. I think we just need to try and put telehealth in a little bit of context, in the sense that it's another way of interacting with patients. And a lot of the issues that Julianne brought up, all the visual cues and those sort of personal cues that you miss on face-to-face consultations, not surprising. But the other, perhaps the most important point that comes out of all of this is that telehealth is not the answer for every consultation. Telehealth has got a place, which is something that we both need to learn. If I can say that both doctors and patients need to work out exactly what the right sort of consultations are for that are useful in a telehealth context, but they're not going to be the complete answer, and the preference would always be a face-to-face consultation.
And we'll dive down in a few moments into some of the effects it's having on the business model of some GPs. But Harry, how have doctors reacted to using it? Because I understand there was a bit of a shift once the dust settled a bit.
Yes, so telehealth, you know, we've been advocating for about 10 years for some sort of telehealth item numbers, and they were introduced over 2 weeks at the height of the pandemic, and So people, so GPs were relieved that they were able to safely see patients and patients safely see their GPs at the sort of height of the pandemic. But as a few of my colleagues have said, if my professional life was to be spent just sitting in a cubicle, just telephoning patients, I just couldn't do it. So I think it was good in the beginning for the circumstances that that it was introduced, but going forward we need a better and different model about how we deliver telehealth. It's important that it stays as part of as one of the options on dealing with patients, and a lot of the patients, especially elderly patients, can really benefit from telehealth.
And skills and experience differ very widely across the population. I imagine that's true for GPs too. Do you think doctors need support to get the most out of the technological aspects?
There's no question about that. The vast majority of, you know, almost 100% of doctors haven't really been introduced to telehealth until very recently. A lot of the telehealth that has been done in Australia has been telepsychiatry, so it's really been a specific group of doctors, and obviously psychiatry tends to lend itself to telehealth, especially video consultations. But to introduce it for every condition requires that we all learn about what the right sort of patients and how to conduct those consultations.
The Consumer Health Forum did a survey as well. Lots of surveys going on around telehealth lately, and they found that the vast majority had heard of telehealth, I think 98%, but only a third had ever actually been offered a telehealth service. Why do you think there might be that gap between availability and take-up?
I'd be surprised if a third sounds a little bit low. Certainly at the height of the pandemic, that would have been the discussion that the patient would have had almost with every receptionist, every GP receptionist around Australia was, you know, how's the best way that we can deliver the service that you need? And so that patients would have had a discussion about whether or not they were at risk of COVID-19 and whether or not it would be appropriate for them to actually come into the practice. And so so probably the third seems a little bit low, it is a conversation that I would suggest that almost every patient who's rung their GP in the last 3 months would have probably had.
We've had a text message question from Chris. He says, I was told telehealth is no longer covered by Medicare. Is this right?
No, it's not right. So telehealth, the item numbers are due, they've got sunset clauses on them, so they're due to end on September the 30th. And we're working with the government at the moment to ensure that that telehealth consultations exist beyond September 30 and do become a regular part of general practice and healthcare here in Australia.
We're talking with Dr. Harry Nespolon. He's president of the Royal Australian College of GPs, and Julianne Parkinson from the Global Centre for Modern Ageing. And hopefully with you too, if you're using telehealth during the past few months, if you used it, tell us your experience, whether they were good or bad. We're particularly interested to hear from older Australians, but we will take all comments on our Facebook page. Harry Nespolon, what about the effect on the business models of GPs? We're hearing some reports that GPs are struggling in some areas, that they've seen fewer visits. What light can you shed on that idea?
Well, when the pandemic started, we told everyone to stay home. And as we know, Australians have done a fantastic job in self-isolating, and we've seen the results. Putting aside the little hiccup in Victoria at the moment, that we've managed the pandemic really well. And so patients were, in our understanding, were concerned about going, first of all, leaving home, especially elderly patients, because they were a particularly vulnerable group. And so they were staying home and they were delaying their usual care. And so when this was sort of being understood, we've tried to make sure that patients do understand that general practices are safe places to go. Those conversations that I was just talking about with the receptionist is to make sure that the patient got the best form of consultation, so whether that was a telehealth consultation or a need to come in. But it really did hit general practice. There are practices that were reporting 30% drops in the number of people coming to see them, and that's very slowly recovering at the moment.
And I think that 30% number came from a third of respondents to a survey of 1,000 practices. Harry, telehealth has been long awaited in rural, regional and remote areas. Do you think it's an unalloyed good in those areas?
Look, it's absolutely fantastic in those areas. You know, I can't imagine, you know, taking 2 hours off to drive to the local GP just to get some regular sort of what I'd call sort of administrative healthcare done. And if that can be done over the phone, you know, it's an absolute boon for those patients. And so that, especially for rural and remote. And if we talk about patients with dementia or close to that, often those patients do need to have their adult children come with them to consultations. So not only so that those children are taking often time off from work, and especially for the consultations which are more administrative in function, it's much, you know, it's better for everyone that they're done over the phone or through telehealth. So there are some really fantastic examples where telehealth really does help both the patient, their family and the community.
You've expressed some concerns in the past that it could be a bit of a double-edged sword if you end up with some places that have one practice and that practice says, we just do telehealth now. How likely is that?
Well, where that's happening at the moment is that there are some commercial arrangements where people are just offering telehealth over the phone for all the what we would see as sort of easy consultations. Often businesses that don't have any relationship with any patients at all and certainly are unable to offer face-to-face consultations. Patient safety should be the most important part of telehealth and any other interaction when it comes to the healthcare system. And not being able to do a face-to-face consultation is really what we would see unacceptable if patients have got a condition that isn't dealt with over the phone, and that would be probably the vast, you know, a majority, not the vast majority, a majority of conditions, then they really should be able to, in a reasonable time, see a doctor.
Julianne Parkinson, if you had to make a list, what should we keep and what should we chuck about how telehealth has been working lately?
Well, I think what we should keep is the experience that for people that have been using this for the first time or repeat users, it's been a positive experience from which to have a springboard from which to improve upon. So I think what we have now is an opportunity to learn more about the education and provide education to both the health professional and the patient, and indeed the care or the family member that might need to assist the patient, so that we build towards a more exquisite experience and understand where it fits sensibly in the best interest of the patient, in the blend of offerings that the health services in Australia offer.
And Harry mentioned vulnerable patients. Some of the people, some older Australians fit into that category, not all, but there are people who are very vulnerable to health conditions. What are your thoughts on how we can make that system work for people who might otherwise struggle?
Well, at the Global Centre for Modern Ageing, our work is, this research that that we're chatting about today, but we also get involved in the co-design of the solutions with the end users, or in this case, with the patients, be they vulnerable or not. And so I think what's terribly important is as we build towards the solutions that we co-design this using proper processes and frameworks that are accredited and understood with the right ethics attached, and that we leverage the experiences and the thoughts of people, regardless of their circumstances, to inform the design of the future.
And Harry Nespolon, would GPs be up for that, for co-designing a solution with patients?
Absolutely. And as we've got a lot of work to do with telehealth, we don't have the sort of infrastructure that we need to support telehealth. So, for example, at the beginning of their introduction, we were still carrying prescriptions or faxing prescriptions. You know, we don't have an e-prescription service yet. It's being introduced at the moment. It's been sped up, the development of it, but that's just one example of where if we are going to have an efficient telehealth system, we need to develop the infrastructure around it. So part of it is physical infrastructure, as well as digital infrastructure, and as well as professional infrastructure in terms of learning about the best way to deliver healthcare digitally.
It's so hard to believe the fax machine is still a feature of our lives. Thank you both so much.
Huge.
Dr. Harry Nespolon, President of the Royal Australian College of GPs, thanks for your time.
Anytime.
And Julianne Parkinson, Chief Executive of the Global Centre for Modern Ageing. Really appreciate you joining us. Thank you.
It's a pleasure. Thank you. And our survey continues into the next month if people would like to join the website and be part or download the free survey.
Global Centre for Modern Ageing. Key it into your keyboard now. Michael McKenzie joins us here on Life Matters. Michael, what responses are you seeing?
Well, would you like me to fax them to you or should I just tell you straight out?
Stick it on a pigeon.
People are responding in all kinds of ways. Telehealth, says one texter, is one brilliant way to reduce petrol consumption and traffic congestion in cities. I used it and I think it's an excellent thing, especially when the patient knows the doctor and an ongoing treatment program can be monitored. This one, I'm over 70. I've had a very positive experience with telehealth. I've had to use another doctor at the practice, but have found the GP to be well-informed and work towards a good outcome. I hope this continues. Lauren says, I'm pregnant with my first baby and live more than an hour from Melbourne. I'm booked at a hospital 1 hour, 15 minutes away for specialised care as I'm high risk with pre-existing conditions. Telehealth has been excellent as I've been in consistent contact with my obstetrician, midwife, specialist and psychologist via telehealth and phone without the long commute. And it's been much easier to fit all these appointments in around work. If I've needed to be physically examined, I can see my local GP or go into the hospital where resources are less congested. I have really liked it. That's from Lauren.
Win, 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 win. I had one with a takeaway coffee in the car the other day. It was fantastic. Thank you, Michael.
Was the coffee the actual prescription?
Yeah, I think so, yeah. I think you should sit in that car peacefully for another 10 minutes. I'm pretty sure he said that. Thank you, Michael.
Cheers.
You're listening to Life Matters here on Radio National.
Nearly two-thirds of Australian business.
The Prime Minister says a cyber
attack. The legal community has been left stunned.
In a world where headlines are in your pocket, RN takes you further. We open the door to ideas you don't find anywhere else.
To keep our kids out of the criminal justice system, we need to focus on the whole life course.
We don't believe any investing in thermal coal is a good investment.
Expert minds, thought-provoking insight, great conversations.
Is there any doubt that Beijing means business?
It's the difference between knowing and understanding. RN, think bigger.
Victoria has again forced large parts of Melbourne into lockdown to try to halt the spread of coronavirus. Listing postcodes in the so-called hot zones, where restrictions will apply, Victoria's Premier, Daniel Andrews, says the extraordinary steps were necessary to contain a surge in infections. The orders effectively place some suburbs back under the same restrictions from the start of the pandemic. But will these lockdowns help stop that spread?
Hello, this is CoronaCast, a daily show all about the coronavirus. I'm health reporter Tegan Taylor.
And I'm physician and journalist Dr. Norman Swan.
So, Norman, big news out of Victoria, and it seems parts of Melbourne are going back into lockdown. Can you talk us through what was announced in Victoria and why the Victorian government is imposing it?
The reason they're imposing it is that they've got community spread in certain areas in Melbourne, much of which is in the northern suburbs, but not exclusively in the northern suburbs. The spread has come from hotel quarantine and other areas. They still haven't tied down where a lot of the spread has come from. And they've really got to get this under control before it spreads to the whole of Melbourne. Testing really only works when you've got very small numbers of cases as a primary means of control. If you're losing control of it, the only thing that works is social distancing. A testing infrastructure keeps it under control, but they've lost control with a good testing infrastructure. That means you've got to go back to social distancing to regain control.
So we've heard about so-called ring fencing over the past few days. What is that, and is it what they're going to do in Victoria?
Ring fencing is what they did to control the SARS-1 epidemic back in 2003, and it's really an old technique in public health where you isolate a suburb or an area, but you completely isolate it. And they did it in Wuhan, and people will remember they saw barricades where people didn't get in or out. And the other thing that they did with ring fencing is that they removed people from their homes into quarantine areas. You might remember they built in Wuhan a hospital within a few days, a week, more than one hospital, in fact. And that was to really take people out of their homes because it's impossible to social distance at home and isolate them in a quarantine area where they're actually quite free to walk around because everybody's got COVID-19 and keep them there for 14 days or until, in fact, they're negative. that's not what they're doing in Melbourne. They're not ring-fencing the suburbs. Some of these suburbs are very difficult to ring-fence, like Broadmeadows in the northern suburbs of Melbourne. It's a semi-industrial suburb. It's got large highways going through. It's hard to imagine how you would completely ring-fence it. But what they've managed to do in Wuhan is pretty much eliminate spread, pretty much almost eradicate the virus. And it is a way of actually getting the virus down to incredibly low levels. So this is not ring-fencing. This is lockdown testing and trying to actually get it under control that way. And hopefully it'll manage, because there's not that much virus around. There's a fair bit, but it's not massive. The other thing that happens in ring fencing is that people wear masks. And as far as I'm aware, this has not been recommended in Victoria at this stage. So they're still resisting the wearing of masks. And this really could help those suburbs to get things under control faster. I think what they're assuming is that if people are socially distanced and staying at home, you don't need masks, you can't wear masks at home, which is true. Well, you can actually, but when they go out, when they go shopping and so on, it does minimize the risk of spread. But anyway, we got it under control without masks before, but we did have schools closed and fewer people circulating. So let's see what happens. But masks could help in this situation, but they haven't chosen that yet.
Well, that's all we've got time for today. You can find the full 10-minute version of CoronaCast wherever you get your podcasts.
That's health reporters Tegan Taylor and Dr. Norman Swan. It's the first day of the rest of your life and a new financial year, which is probably more immediately relevant. That time when many of us start to think about getting our bits and bobs together in hopes of a nice little tax refund, or at least staying in the black this year. But this year, things are quite different, and it will pay to be across that. Emily Stewart is an ABC business reporter and the editor of the Your Money Explained newsletter. Emily, hello again.
Good morning, Hillary. Can't believe we're halfway through the year already.
I know. It feels like about 2024 right now.
Yes.
But we're going to be prepared for the rest of the year and years to come. Should we be rushing in to get our tax returns done like good little employees?
Well, it seems strange, but the tax office has actually recommended we all wait a little bit, and doing it towards the end of July, not right now, is probably your best bet. And that's because a lot of our information is now digitally sent across to the ATO. So in the past, our employers often gave us payment summaries, for instance, and now that's all done digitally. And the same with if you're on government benefits. We need to give time for Services Australia to send that information across to the ATO. So they actually say perhaps just gathering all your information, but actually waiting until the end of July might be a best bet to have all your information pre-populated, just to make it easier for you to do it.
So information digitally travelling around about our finances without human oversight, that has not worked so well for the government in the past. Should we be worried about this?
Well, I don't think so. That we've already been doing it, this new system, especially for the income statements from employers. It's just that they're ramping up this year. So 4 million employees should be getting their income information done this way. And I just hope that they're secure, but we'll find out.
Well, Michael McKenzie will be looking at cyber crime soon and how we can keep ourselves safe. Perhaps there'll be some tips there. Emily Stewart, what if we've been getting JobKeeper or JobSeeker payments? Is that taxable just like if you were getting paid wages?
Yes, so many of our government benefits are actually taxed, but it all depends on your marginal rate and what other income you've earned during the year. So for JobSeeker, for example, if you did have a job earlier in the financial year, you might have earned over the amount where you pay no tax. So, you know, the way our marginal tax rate system works is if you earn under $18,200 for the financial year, you don't pay tax. But if you earn anything over that, you do. So it really does depend on individual circumstances. And there wasn't an option to get Services Australia to withhold some of the money that you would receive But I doubt that many people would have been able to do that or would have thought to do that because I assume that they needed the money immediately and that's why they're on JobSeeker. But JobKeeper is a little bit different because that's really a system. It's meant to replicate your normal payment through your employer. So your employer should have withheld tax as usual and so they will send across that information by the end of July and you will be paying that at your marginal tax rate again, depending on what you've earned for the rest of the year.
And again, I guess it's a bit of a cross fingers moment, isn't it? It was introduced so quickly and everyone was a bit in a panic at the time. We hope that it's worked out the way it's meant to. A lot of people, Emily, lost their jobs this financial year too. What about redundancy and stand down payments? Do they have tax implications?
Yes, so if you were stood down by your employer, perhaps before JobKeeper was announced and they gave you some money to get by, that is just meant to be included in your income. That will be taxed. Redundancy is a little bit different and it's very up to your individual circumstances. It's quite complicated, but it usually comes, the money you receive usually has three different parts. One part's usually tax-free and that's based on your years of service. Another part you might pay at your normal marginal tax rate. And then another part you might get a bit of a discount on your normal marginal tax rate. So usually your employer would help you to work this out, but also it's well worth having look on the ATO website and they might be able to help you do some calculations there. But of course, this is all just general information. And if you need individual advice, please talk to your employer or talk to your tax accountant.
Indeed. Emily Stewart is ABC business reporter and the editor of the Your Money Explained newsletter. She's walking us through some of the tax time tips we might need to get under our belt for this very different new financial year here in 2020. Emily, okay, let's look at the working from home issue. What can and can't you claim?
Yes, so the tax office realised, obviously, that so many of us were working from home. And when you work from home, you incur all those extra expenses that you wouldn't if you were out at the workplace or in the office. So things like you're paying more for the internet, you're paying for heating where you wouldn't normally, you're paying to have the lights on. And so they wanted to come up with an easier system for people to use to make some claims. So they've come up with a shortcut method where essentially you can claim 80 cents per hour worked at home between the 1st of March and the 30th of June. And to do that, you just need to keep a diary of your hours or a timesheet. It can be just a physical diary or you can do it with your Outlook, perhaps your regular, whatever you use as a diary. And the tax office has done the calculations and it should add up to a deductions of about $500 if you've worked full time at home during that period. The good thing about this method is that multiple people in the same household can claim it. So if you're in a share house, or perhaps you're a couple and both of you are working from home, it means that you can at least both claim something. Whereas if you use one of the two other traditional methods for working from home expenses, you can't both claim the same portion of the internet for work, for instance, or you both can't claim the lights because you're in the same house and the lights are on. So it does mean that you can, both individuals can make a claim. But it's well worth doing the calculations. For instance, if you've made a large purchase or if you have a particularly large internet or phone bill, it might be worth using one of the other existing methods.
That's really interesting. We're a tag team household, so we're both working at home but different portions of the day. So the lights are on the whole time, the heater's on the whole time, but two different people are using them at different times. I'm going to have to chase that one up. What about things like hand sanitizer and masks? I was wondering if that would fall under the same idea as sunscreen for people who work outside.
Yes. So if you're in a customer-facing role, if you've had to have a lot of contact with the public, I suppose, or with other people, perhaps in an industry like healthcare or retail or hospitality, if you've still been able to work, you've had to buy gloves or hand sanitizer or masks, any of those sort of health related purchases, and you haven't been reimbursed by your employer, but you needed to use them for work, then you can probably claim those. But of course, if you've just bought them for your personal use, we can't claim that because it's nothing to do with the income that you earn.
So if, say, your employer ran out and you brought your own, would that count?
Well, if you've had to buy it and you haven't been reimbursed, then yes, you should be able to claim it. But just make sure you keep all your receipts and any other evidence.
Indeed. What about travel? I assume that that will just plummet the amount of expenses we can claim about work-related travel this year.
Yes, so the tax office is expecting that things like travel will go right down. And so be careful if you are sort of not being accurate with your claims, because it's quite clear that most of us won't have been travelling. And also things like laundry expenses, they're expecting to go down, because if you haven't been wearing your work uniform, you shouldn't have had to send it out to get dry cleaned, for instance. So they're expecting those to go down. Another question that's come up a lot is, if you're working from home and you have to travel into the office, can you claim that since you're now basically permanently working from home? And no, you can't actually claim that travel, because the tax office considers that, you know, this is a temporary thing that you're working from home, and you can't claim that travel in between home and the office, because in normal times you also can't claim that traveling to work expense.
What about toilet paper? Now that we're all paying for our own toilet paper at home, I was reading how that was part of the drivers of the panic buying, because we're not using it at work anymore.
Yes, well, no, we can't claim things like tea or coffee. You can't claim things like rent or the interest on your mortgage. And so you've just got to be very careful to keep it really pretty strictly to running expenses, which is more to do with the electricity, with the heating, with the internet and the phone, and depreciation on equipment. If you've had to buy computers or chairs or desks for a home setup, you can claim some of the decline in the value of that equipment. And it all depends on which of those working from home methods you do. So if you've got a complicated setup and you're not quite sure, you might be best either reading the ATO website very carefully, or perhaps going to a registered tax accountant.
And Emily, just finally, what if you're one of the large number of people who got an early release of their super? Is that taxable?
Well, you don't actually have to pay tax if you took out money from the early release of super. So you don't need to write that in anywhere on your tax return as income if you've done it through that system. However, if you had taken out, because you can also in normal times take money out from super if you're facing financial hardship, and if you've done it through that system, you do have to pay tax. So just be very careful to realise which system you'd used. But yes, if you've accessed the early release of super through that scheme, which most people who'd got super out early would have used that scheme, you don't have to include that anywhere. So you can just forget about that for now in terms of your tax return anyway.
One less thing. So Emily, don't put your tax returns in until at least the end of July. When's a safe time to do that?
Well, I think anytime towards the end of July, if you log on to MyGov, which is the way if you're doing it yourself, and go through to MyTax, and you'd be able to check whether your income information has come across either from Services Australia or from your employer. So you could always start checking from, you know, mid-July, and if you're one of the lucky ones whose information has come across, you can get going and hopefully get a tax return. But if not, just keep checking until it comes across, or perhaps wait until the 1st of August, for instance. But you've got until October 31st to do your taxes if you're doing it yourself. But if you're using a tax agent, you've got much longer, so there's much less stress.
Good to know. Emily Stewart, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you, Hilary.
ABC Business reporter and editor of the Your Money Explained newsletter. You can subscribe via the ABC News front page. And as Emily mentioned, this information is general in nature. You should get individual advice from your tax accountant or the ATO if you have specific questions. This is Life Matters.
So, more than $1 billion and 500 new jobs forecast over the next 10 years. That's the latest commitment from the Morrison government to fighting the war against breaches of our data security. And it is a war. Cyber attacks on essential services are now commonplace, and language like state actors, denial of service, and firewall breaches are sadly all part of how competing interests do their work. But what's that got to do with you and me at street level? Well, take me for example. I consider myself pretty online savvy. I take security precautions at home and at work. And yet, I got ripped off last week because I believed a cheap mobile phone was too good to let slip. I've taken steps to get my money back, so fingers crossed, but I feel like an idiot because the signs were there. So what kinds of protection have you got in place? This stuff matters, whether you're in government, a small business owner, or a person who hardly goes on Facebook. My next guest cares deeply about helping us protect ourselves, so I'm going to ask some dumb questions on behalf of all of us. Rachel Falk is the CEO of the Cybersecurity Cooperative Research Centre in Canberra. Rachel, hello. Welcome to the show.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Rachel, I've got to ask straight up, has working from home for so many of us introduced new vulnerabilities to our data protection?
Look, I think it has, absolutely. I think a couple of reasons for that. Some of us worked from home who really weren't used to doing it full-time before. So it sent a whole bunch of workers who normally would have been in shops or workplaces home to work. And that meant many of them were also on their home devices, so they didn't get the protection of perhaps the same protection in a cybersecurity sense that they were getting from work. Secondly, a lot of people were just simply distracted, and rightly so. Some people were dealing with little kids, pets, big kids, parents, grandparents, whole bunch of distractions at home, which meant you probably weren't as attentive as you could have been, and all for right reasons, and worry about COVID. And that kind of sent people, rightly so, into a different space at the moment when they were working from home.
Just saying that conjured up for me this image of the kids make a noise behind, you're actually on work email, you turn around to pacify, you turn back, there's an invitation on a new email to click this button, and you just do it.
Absolutely. You're absolutely right, because part of it was also wanting to appear for some of us that we were on top of our jobs. So I don't want people to think I'm getting behind, or you might have also had a casual job, so work security was really important. So you're just not thinking, you know, there could have, as you say, baby in the background, you're clicking on a link, you didn't think about it. It's entirely feasible that not only was it challenging, but yeah, cyber defences weren't both from a human perspective and from a computer perspective where they should have been.
Is it true to say that state actors, and we're talking here about major mm-hmm. state actors, have yep. any care at all about what we do day to day in our PC and business lives?
Well, so just for everyone out there, a major state actor is really an intelligence service from a big country. So when we mean that, we mean they're very well resourced. Should yep. we care? We should care, because there's numerous examples from here and overseas that suggest that nation states do often hoover up large amounts of data, but often from large websites and large repositories, often and companies, not from small consumers. But what I think is important is every piece of data, be it personal or government data, that's all little bits of data often about us. So whilst average person doesn't need to be so concerned about a nation state targeting them, what they do need to be concerned about is when they enter in data, personal data of their own, to a website, they should be always asking themselves, do I have to enter this data? In some cases with government, you have no choice because you might need to get a service or enter details. That's all legitimate. But other places, what I've seen is people giving up data they don't need to give up, say, to enter a competition or to get a benefit, or in your case, really unfortunately, a scam. They end up giving yep. away data, and that's part of the scam, actually, is to give away data, because that data can be used for identity theft, impersonation, and a whole range of other scams. So we really do need to protect your personal data wherever it's possible to do so in everyday life.
This is really interesting, because what constitutes important data to us and what's interesting data for those people who mm-hmm. have malignant purposes at hand, it always intrigues me. So let's say, for example, my credit card details are being yep. stolen from an online yep. account. What yep. happens to them next? Are they unsold?
Yes, what can happen to the next is, it could be a range of things. It could be a garden variety person who simply got them by opening your mail, although banks are quite careful not to give all the details. But they've managed to, say, piece together your credit card. They've found a credit card, say. They can then just use that for their own purposes. But, yes, wholesale theft of credit cards can then be repurposed and found and resold on the dark web. So there is a whole industry behind that. So that's why it's important that when people go to pay with a credit card online, they look for the padlock up the top of the site that says there's a level of security on that site. So guarding things like credit card details are really, really important. Not letting your credit card out of your site when you go to a restaurant, That's why you see that the person often comes to you when you want to pay. Things like that, because your details can then be copied and reused. It's really important people check their statements weekly, monthly, to make sure that they actually are keeping track of what purchases are what. If they see a mysterious purchase, to ring their bank and to get that. The banks are very good if, say, in your case, you're scammed. They try very hard to get the money back. Sometimes they can't. It's gone offshore. But they do try and work very closely with the customer to stop further fraud, but certainly try and recover funds wherever possible.
Now, when it comes to transactions, Rachel, one of the safety mechanisms that's now rife throughout all our online world is two-step authentication.
Yep.
This is where you type a password and then your mobile or email gets a verification code that you have to key in as well. Is that preventative? Is that doing the job it's supposed to?
Well, nothing's preventative, because sometimes people can also get your phone or get hold of your phone, so they have that second factor authentication. But yes, is it a good step? Absolutely. And it shouldn't be seen as an inconvenience, because what the bank is actually doing when they're doing that is they're sending a code to you to make sure you are you and you're authorising that transaction. So wherever possible, on your banking accounts, on your social media, on anything, you should have two-factor authentication, because it's really a way of that of verifying that the user is actually you. Because if they send a code, and how it works is you may type in or you may know that person's password, but if a separate code is being sent to the authorised user, you as the criminal won't get that code. So it's a good way of the person who actually is a legitimate user saying, "Ah, oh, why have I got this code coming up? I'm not signed into this account." And then they'll be able to ring the bank and go, "I think something's wrong. I'm getting a code. I'm not using my device at the moment." So it is actually a really important step. Is it foolproof 100%? No, nothing is, but it's certainly a really good step to try and protect accounts.
My guest is Rachel Falk. She's the CEO of the Cybersecurity Cooperative Research Centre in Canberra. And we're talking here about some of the pros and cons and the pitfalls for you and I as grassroots internet users when it comes to protecting our data, particularly during these fraught times of state actors as well. I keep using the term because it sounds so amazing. sort of basically doing cyber warfare with each other in light of the fact that the federal government is about to announce today a huge amount of money, resources and new staffing to deal with cyber warfare. Rachel, I meet in my line of work a lot of people who, and I'm not judging them, but aren't that computer literate. Mm-hmm. They've learnt patterns of behaviour around a keyboard, but no one really has taught them how things work or what to look out for. Is that lack of understanding of how things connect one of our great vulnerabilities in this country?
Look, it's completely understandable that not everyone is computer savvy, and that's really, really reasonable for us to accept that. And people, I should really point out, shouldn't feel ashamed about that.
No.
But can they do simple things to improve their cyber literacy? Absolutely. Things like good, strong passwords. So not having passwords like Rachel1234 or Michael1234, having things where you just string four random words together. Having a password app or writing, and my mother does this, writing them down, maybe not such a good idea, but remembering complex passwords somewhere is really important. So certainly no shame in not being computer literate. But what it does mean is if you've got that computer at home and you never patch it because, you know, Microsoft or Apple are telling you to update it and it's just too annoying, you must do that, because that is your operating system of your whole computer. It means what your computer is doing is wants to repair vulnerabilities, because whilst nation states sound all very out there and they'd never be after me, they'll just scan, and it's not just nation states, it's just cyber criminals will scan the internet, the network, looking for computers that might be unpatched, looking for vulnerabilities. What that means is, can they take things from you? Well, if you've just got your recipes and some games, that's probably not of great importance, but you might have some key statements or key material you've kept on your computer for ages. It gives away your name, your date of birth, your place of birth. All could be used for identity theft. It's just a small piece of data in a bigger puzzle. I should probably stress, though, too, it's not just cyber fraud. It's things also scams, phone scams, like you perhaps mentioned, where you
That's
get
right.
run
I keep rubbing
up.
It in, Rachel. Thanks very
oh,
much.
Oh, I
it's
know.
Great.
I'm sorry. But, again, please don't feel ashamed. My beautiful mother rang me not long ago and said to me, I've been rung by this offshore lottery, and they say I'm eligible for a lottery, and I've checked it out online, and they look legitimate. And I said, Mum, give me the name, whatever it was, can't remember it, went in, and it's a known site for doing this. So remember that these scammers aren't just they're not worried necessarily about your computer. They're so sophisticated, they'll have a website set up for a lottery that you could win. They'll have a number that connects to people who purport to work for the lottery. So I'd really also say to older people, particularly, your number just could be randomly called. You're not targeted, randomly called. And that's the way they say that things like, well, if you give us your details or we'll come back to you, or you might need a little bit of payment to release this lottery. Please, there's no shame in that. Talk to a member of your family. My poor mother's berated all the time by me, probably, to say, no, no, Mum, this isn't a real lottery. But these kind of people, they prey on people's goodwill. They prey on the fact we kind of don't expect a stranger on the other end of the phone to want to scam us.
That's right, to do us harm. And in fact, even despite me, you know, pretending that I know what I'm doing, that's what happened. I got appealed to and they showed me what I thought was proof that they existed, and I still got scammed. Now, in another life, you were Telstra's first general manager of cyber influence. And at that time, you co-authored the five no's, as in K-N-O-W-S, of cybersecurity. Are they useful for us now?
Absolutely. And for the users out there, I'll just go through it. They absolutely are. They're something we applied at Telstra internally, but something I still remember to this day. The first one, if we're talking about us as individuals, know the value of your data. So that is, what's valuable data to me that I don't really need to trade? I'll give you an example. I was away once with my kids and we were going to swim with dolphins and they wanted me to sign this complex indemnity but wanted a lot more detail than they needed, much to the collective eye-rolling and groaning of my children. I said, look, you don't need all that data. I'll give you this and this, but I'm not going to share with you dates of birth and all that kind of stuff. You don't need that for this document. Right. So it's really knowing when to share. A great example for the listeners, loyalty cards. When you go into a shop and they say, would you like to sign up with our new loyalty program? They're asking you a lot of questions. They don't need my date of birth to sell me a good sweater or let me be on the list about when their sales come up. So know the value of the data and think to yourself, think twice, do I really need to share this, my personal data, with this organisation in order to get the benefit?
Rachel, we're running out of time, so maybe the other four just quickly.
Yeah. Sure. No has access to your data, so that is where do you share it with and who do you knowingly share it with? Know where it is, that is as in where do you might put your data in clouds or secure it all over the place. Know how well it's protected, so know what software and what protections you have. And know how well it's protected. So who's protecting it and how well it's protected. Who's looking after your data more generally with your banks and other people, but also what you're doing at home with virus and patching and things like that, antivirus. Yeah. So they're the ones I live by and they're good advice.
That's right. So, and I love that thing on your website, patch, 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 always upgrade, no matter always what it upgrade. Is, antivirus, malware, software, whatever it is, keep it up to date.
Yes.
Absolutely. Great. Rachel, it's been a pleasure. Thank you very much for coming on and giving us some guidance here.
My pleasure, and thank you very much for having me.
Rachel Falk, she's the CEO of the Cybersecurity Cooperative Research Centre in Canberra, and I've offered Rachel Hillary a very special opportunity to get in on the ground floor of a brand new business venture online, but she hasn't responded.
It's amazing, isn't it?
Go figure.
Some people.
What are people saying online?
Well, let's go to a quick text question on tax. Someone says, did your guest mistakenly say you could claim 80 cents per hour, not 8 cents? The answer is yes, it is 80 cents per hour. The ATO website agrees. That's from the 1st of March to the 30th of June. But the bulk of responses, Michael, were on telehealth and lockdowns. Mavis says, we think telehealth is the best thing since sliced bread. We're pensioners. It makes it easier for us. Please keep it. We're happy people. We've used it twice for low-level question-answer type consultations and it worked so well and people were very friendly.
And then Helen says in Bathurst, hi, Hillary, none of my telehealth consultations worked. And I ended up each time doing them over the phone. Frustrating and less than satisfactory. I live 200 kilometres from Sydney in a large regional town.
Lots of different views. Someone says, I don't think GPs realise that sitting for long waiting times in waiting rooms is unpleasant, particularly with a huge television that no one wants to watch. If the doctor has good communication skills, telehealth is very helpful. If they don't, then it is ghastly.
Lisa says that culturally diverse community members generally don't like telehealth. That's what she's asserting. And health workers are reporting the same when having to use interpreters. Face-to-face is reported to be preferred in those cases.
Thank you, Michael. On our next program, we knew housing stress was bad under the pandemic lockdowns, but we didn't know how bad it was. The number of Australians who couldn't pay their rent or mortgage on time in May more than doubled on the April numbers. Now there's concern that the coronavirus is not only fueling housing stress and financial hardship, but that housing stress and social inequity could limit a person's ability to self-isolate. And that has implications for all of us. We'll ask an epidemiologist how that might play out on Life Matters next time.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.